Jeff, you've given us some fascinating tools to deal with the frustration that was pretty profound. You know, you're ready to go. You've had a good leg. You're really fired up. You're on your way to Oshkosh. And then all of a sudden, bang, you know, you got this frustration staring you in the face. But some neat tools here. Let's start with working with ATC and understanding the capabilities of ATC to be your friend rather than an adversary.
Yeah, absolutely. I think there are two parts to that, Bob. One is just because ATC came back with a particular clearance doesn't mean you're stuck with it, right? You're still pilot in command. You had a reason for asking for a different routing and you didn't get it. That doesn't mean you have to hang your head and go, oh, well, and try and, you know, take it and work it out as it goes. And then the other side is understanding how the system works so that you can get the thing you want to get you the tools you need to work with, in this case, filing a destination you don't intend to land at, and then work it out with ATC in the air. They're your, you know, partner in making this happen. As long as you use the tool wisely, respectfully, and within the rules, then you have a much greater range of latitude to work with.
And there's a lot of places in the country where this is real. I mean, Oshkosh is a great example because, you know, there's a, you know, everybody's en route to this place and it becomes a very dense. But working the East Coast, the East Coast is literally they'll send you, you know, way out to Pennsylvania to get to somewhere you want to get to on the East Coast. And there's a lot of ways to skin that cat. And instead of, you know, letting the frustration mount up and, well, I'll cancel. And that's the worst thing when when all of a sudden you cancel, you know, now you're out there, you know, as a menace to the system as opposed to working with the system and everybody winning. Win-win versus lose-lose.
Right. Absolutely.
The other challenge is, you know, weather avoidance. You know, once again, weather, huge frustration. Oh, we're here and now we got these thunderstorms, you know. Take us through the sequence of events you use to work with the system to get you around the thunderstorms because, by golly, we don't want to mess with them.
Right. I think one of the things that people talk about and toss back and forth is this idea of strategic planning versus tactical planning. So strategic planning was, we looked at the thunderstorms, or the pilot in this scenario, the same thing, is looking at the thunderstorms across Canada and saying, that's just no-go. And in the real world that this is based on, there wasn't even a question. I mean, you know, it was lit up with lightning. Like I said, there was hail. We couldn't even get close to that. But there was a beautiful area that was very comfortably wide as long as we could follow along the lake. So strategically, we wanted to go in that direction, and this tool let us do it. Now, as it played out in the real world, small storms were popping up as we worked our way. If you watched our track on FlightAware, you would have seen us deviating left some more, deviating right, deviating left. That's the tactical part where almost the entire flight we managed to stay in the clear. You know, the nice part was we did have XM weather on board, which isn't something you can use to deviate around the storms, but it gave us an idea of where they were building up. And okay, that whole quadrant over there, I'm watching more and more stuff. So if we have to decide a deviation, it's not going to be to the right for now. It's going to be over to the left. And then we worked the left a little bit. The right was simmering down. Okay, that's looking a little better over there. So that's going to be my preferred route of deviation. But the actual deviations are what we're seeing outside ahead of us. And again, listening to other airplanes, working with ATC to a degree, but you know, there you have a lot of other irons in the fire. They may not be seeing what exactly we're seeing. So I'll take that into consideration. But mostly it's sitting in the airplane and trying to keep yourself visual. And we actually were only in the clouds for short periods of time. And that was the most nerve-wracking part of the flight, to tell you the truth. I couldn't see ahead.
John, take us inside the ATC system. You know, you have the luxury of sitting on the other side of the microphone. And you know, what are the things that pilots can do to help facilitate, you know, both sides getting what they want? Specifically, you know, filing multiple flight plans based upon the fact that, you know, you may want to go this route and you may want to go another route. Can you help us out with that perspective?
Sure. I guess you back up a little bit. The system in constrained areas is pretty tight. We talk about, you know, Southern California, Northern California, the East Coast in New York. Flows and things are very, very tightly restricted, and there's so much interaction between the different facilities that individual controllers don't have a lot of latitude in what they can negotiate, what they can create. So there are letters of agreement between the facilities, and there's preferred routings for airport pairs between those facilities. And to eliminate the controller's workload, the ATC computer will automatically generate those preferred routes. So you can file whatever you want between two airports. The system will look at the two fixes and generate on the strip the preferred route. Controller has very little latitude over that. As opposed to a less constrained area when you're talking out in the Midwest, Buffalo West, pretty much there are letters of agreement and things will probably have no defined routings or maybe very minimal defined. So the technique that Jeff's talking about is actually very useful because basically what you're doing is telling the system that you want to go in a different direction. You want to go to a different airport, and it will apply the preferential routing for that. The downside of that, of course, is you may wind up in a situation where you can't change out of that, and you may have to accept that. As far as filing multiple flight plans, that just bear in mind that it's going to be the controller's responsibility to clarify which flight plan you're going to use, and you can help the controller also by telling them the information that you need. One way might be, as Bob was talking about, filing slightly different departure times. So you can reference, I want the 1400 flight plan as opposed to the 1410 flight plan. It's just a way of identifying them because you don't have the knowledge of the computer codes that the controller does. So that's one way of doing it. The other way of doing it would be to include in the remarks routing requested due to weather. And that gives the controller who's reviewing the flight plan before it's even issued to you a heads up. If the system is really constrained in the fact that there's a lot of weather, especially in congested areas, again, the FAA will institute what they call a playbook. They actually have certain canned routes that will bypass weather. And they will initiate that on a system-wide basis. That generally is more for the high-altitude guys. Us low-altitude guys are pretty much on our own when it comes to that kind of stuff. So probably the biggest thing is the communication, is just telling the controller, I need this routing because of that, and let the controller go work what they can to do it. And you may or may not get it, but at least you've given the controller the reason why you need to do that.
Bob, you're in your corporate flying. Obviously, you're faced with daily challenges of managing change. What are some of the other tools that you found that are helpful? Obviously, you know, a knowledge of the system and a lot of planning goes into that, doesn't it?
A lot of planning does go into it, and it's very much worthwhile to develop a group of airports that you can use on a flight. For instance, this flight is westbound to Oshkosh. Well, what you want to do is maintain your momentum of going westbound. So you need a list of qualified airports, airports with maintenance, airports that are attended, airports that have fuel, airports that have lodging close by. All of those things are important. And then when you get into a situation at Buffalo and you can't proceed as you had originally planned, well, you've got two or three other airports that may be 20 or 30 degrees off your intended course, but you know you can arrive at these airports safely and avoid weather, and that they are suitable airports where you're not going to become stranded. And from then, you can then plan the next leg of your flight. Sometimes you're not going to do a flight as you planned, straight through, nonstop. Things happen, and the weather is very, very capricious in the sense that it changes so rapidly that it's tough to have a defined plan that you're working with. You need a number of options. You need option A, option B. If I get to Buffalo and I can't go, well, I've got option B, which is what Jeff did in this case. They had another airport that they had identified that was suitable, and as it turned out, the forecasted weather for that area was good, so they leapfrog to the next airport. And the idea is to stay away from the storms. Absolutely stay away from the storms. Don't even get close to them. You've got issues that you have to remember that will cause you problems even before you were to enter a storm. If you follow the philosophy, well, I'm going to fly up to the storm and land at the an available airport that I find before the storm line. Well, you've got issues. You've got wind shear, which may precede the storm. If you are picking airports at random to land at, well, it may not be a suitable airport. It may not be attended. Fuel may not be available. There's a number of things there. You need defined plans which you're going to stick with. Random flying is seldom going to accomplish what you want.
Wally, one of the keys to flying safely is avoiding stress and keeping the level in the cockpit manageable, avoiding surprises. How different is the perspective when we fly proactively versus reactively? And don't way too many pilots do reactive flying rather than proactive flying?
Oh, I think so, Bob. And I think Jeff made a point that when they were in the clouds a little earlier, when they were in the clouds around these thunderstorms, the stress level was much higher because they could not see the tops, could not see whether they how far they were going, even though he had some pretty good equipment to help him there. So yes, I think that brings the stress up. You know, Jeff gave us a good tool for being proactive to miss this. On a recent trip a year or so ago, we were trying to go west from Texas over the Rocky Mountains to California, and we had a big similar situation, a big line of thunderstorms north-south in front of us, and we looked at that and decided we didn't want to deal with high terrain and thunderstorms, and certainly not the ability to top them or do that. And so we studied that for a little while, and alternatively, we filed to an airport 2 hours straight south. And where we expected the thunderstorms were going to end sooner, and they were much more scattered, and it moved us to an area of lower terrain. So we agreed we would fly to that destination, stop, refuel, evaluate the weather, make our next decision after the landing. And it worked out fine. The storms didn't develop down there. We were able to get around them and through them. And so it's, I think, proactive, as you say. There was no stress for us. We made that 2.5-hour trip in low terrain, no weather. And when we finally did encounter the scattered weather, we were in an area where the terrain was much safer.
So one other thing I just want to bring out to add on to that. If you change destination, okay, you file to point A, and at some point you change it to a different airport, you still have to meet all the legal requirements for that new airport, okay? You know, if an alternate is required, you got to make sure now that your weather is suitable for that airport, and you may have to actually declare another alternate, which ATC is not really concerned about, but at least you're going to have to make sure that you have the flight planning for that. Make sure you have the NOTAMs for the new place that you're now declaring as your destination. You know, you can't just like throw a dart at a map and pick this airport. I can remember a trip not too long ago where I did exactly that, changed destination, and found out when I got to the new airport that one of the runways was closed. And I had never bothered checking NOTAMs for that airport because I wasn't even thinking about landing there. So you got to meet all those legal requirements for the new airport, much the same as if you had initially filed
that,
it.
That speaks to having a list of qualified airports.
Exactly, that you've pre-qualified, that I checked the NOTAMs for not only the alternate and the destination, but my paper alternate and my real alternate.
Actually, that brings up a really good point in a slightly different execution of this. Let's suppose you get up in the air and you've got kick and tailwinds are way better than you thought. And you're like, hey, I can actually skip my destination and get to my fuel stop and get to where I'm really going. This is fantastic. Now in the air, I'm going to have to make a change and get NOTAMs and redo my fuel calculation, everything. And I may not be able to get the NOTAMs in the air unless I call ATC and ask, can you give me the NOTAMs for this new destination that I have?
And they're going to give you flight services frequency.
Yeah, they might. And or if it's a quiet day, yeah, they might say, hang on, I got nothing else to do. It's 1 o'clock in the morning. I mean, whatever it happens to be, you work it out. But you have other resources that are available, but also other responsibilities. Just as if you were flight planning on the ground, now you got to run through it.
You tend not to think of that while you're doing it. And how many times have you just picked out an ad hoc airport while you're flying along? Just, oh, geez, they got cheap gas or something, you know, and pick it out and land there. So,
but expect to be asked why you're changing the destination.
Oh yeah, yeah, and that's a requirement. That's a post 9/11 requirement now too. The controller is required to do that.
Jeff, you introduced a subject that I think we need to do a little bit more looking at, and that's oxygen. It's a wonderful tool. It's a valuable tool. But how often do pilots, you know, use this tool? And if you don't use something on a regular basis, might that be a trap that could lead us into some real problems?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think, you know, oxygen's my favorite gas. I love the stuff. And one of the reasons I've thought about this is I know personally, despite the fact that I'm fairly athletic, I have a very low critical altitude personally. If I spend much time above 10,000 feet, I get headaches and my impairment goes down. Forget about this 12, 5, 30-minute thing. Yeah, 10,000 is my altitude. For any length of time, I know I need a little bit of supplemental oxygen. And so there are a couple pieces. One is having a good sense of where you personally deoxygenate. And it costs almost nothing to get a little pulse oximeter and know for yourself, you know, hey, about 11,000 feet for me or 9,000 feet for this person or whatever it is. That's where I need to start thinking about this. And then two is if you've got a system to make sure it works, make sure it doesn't leak, have a good sense of how fast you're going to consume it, you know, your type of cannula or whether you have oxygen, you know, saving cannulas, those, they make a big difference. And then three, to think about it like fuel, right? If you're going to be above a certain altitude and you know you want oxygen, you're going to be consuming a fluid, you know, above that altitude, and you only have so much in the tank. And so start a timer when you start your oxygen.
And
you
can't see likely it. There's a chart in your POH which indicates how long a given amount of oxygen will supply X number of people.
Right, for an onboard system.
Right.
Or if you have a portable system, which a lot of people do, you know, you'll need some way of sensing how fast that goes down. Make sure you can reach the valves. Make sure you can see how much pressure is left in the tank. And just like you'd plan to have a fuel reserve, plan to have an oxygen reserve. Don't expect to run all the way to the bitter end just when you're going to start your descent. You hit extra headwinds, especially up high. You get a delay around something, you're out of oxygen.
Don't forget, if you're going to use oxygen, it needs to be part of your pre-flight planning. It's too late to start getting the masks out as you climb through 12,000 feet.
Yeah, absolutely.
And you absolutely need to know how to monitor the supply, whether it's actually flowing to the masks.
Yeah, we had the terrible event recently where several, there's far too many, you know, well-qualified, very good pilots that got themselves in trouble. And once again, the insidious part of oxygen deprivation is, you know, we go into la-la land and we are not being logical. And everybody understands, you need to understand hypoxia and the effects of hypoxia, because as you're right, you may have never been there before. And what are your effects of hypoxia? And in the military, you know, we were well trained in that. We practiced oxygen deprivation, so we knew how we would respond. And if you're getting it for the first time, it's going to be a real slap in the face and maybe too late. So that's a good issue.
I want to say a word about the fatigue factor. You may perform well at 9 or 10,000 feet without oxygen, but extending the day through a 10-hour day to go to Oshkosh at that altitude, you're really not going to be in very good shape to deal with the traffic at Oshkosh at the end of that period, because high altitude is fatiguing.
And drying also.
Yes.
Yeah. Breathing dry oxygen.
One thing that can be really helpful to people, and this is way, and I say my altitude is about 9,500, 10,000 feet. There have been a lot of studies, not enough, I would say, but there have been some studies on exactly where the saturation is that performance begins to tank. And it turns out down to about 91% saturation, people are still doing pretty well. And the drop-off between 91 and 87% saturation is, you know, geometric. So that's kind of a number, if you don't have anything better, to look for. If you're holding 91% or better, probably, I'm not going to say absolutely, but probably you're in pretty good shape. At least gives you a baseline. If you see that you're down around 88, 87%, you need to deal with that. That's like an abnormal situation that requires some action on your part rather than just sort of, oh, that's a problem. I guess I should, you know, think about it.
Another awareness issue that came up as we were talking about this, you know, you chose a long overwater leg. Some pilots, including some folks right here, are not, you know, necessarily comfortable with that. Might you get caught in that trap? Might you get rooted over something that is way beyond your comfort level? And how do you deal with that? Do you accept it? Do you, you know, I mean, it's a real problem. Not only going to Oshkosh, but going down the East Coast, there's some overwater legs that put you out over water. And how do you deal with that? And how do you manage that?
So I'm glad you brought that up, because this is almost I'm not going to say a pet peeve, but I think it's a place that we're really inconsistent. So if you look at that routing, if you go directly over the lake at, say, 10,000 feet-ish in a 150-knot airplane, no wind, you have about a 15-minute window when you're out of gliding distance from shore. That's it. 15 minutes.
Well, that's 15 minutes too long.
So let me – I love that you said that, Bob, because let me challenge that. In a single-engine airplane, you're coming into Portland, Maine on the ILS for runway 29, and that requires – you being vectored out over the water at 1,800 feet in much colder water, in all sorts of weather, for sometimes 5, 6, 7, maybe 10 minutes. And yet we routinely as pilots accept that exposure to risk again and again and again, these low approaches over inhospitable or wet terrain. Is that an oxymoron, wet terrain? Or over water. And we accept that. We don't think about it, saying, well, we're only there for 5 or so minutes. Oh, I've got to do that to make the approach.
There are a number of factors, though. The flight over Lake Michigan is much more inhospitable than the ILS at Portland. You're much closer to humanity and boating traffic than you are in that 15 minutes out in mid-Lake Michigan. It's cold water with very few small craft out there more than 3 miles from shore.
But I think Jeff's point is well taken, is that we don't even think about that. How many times, like the ILS 5 at Groton or you know.
I think about it every time. They've
got their but you think about it and yet you fly it. And I'm not trying to point the finger at anybody. I'm saying that if you are uncomfortable with that situation, this is to Bob's point, to say, I don't want any exposure where I would go down in water, where I would – you know, dive exposure.
Well, we're talking about minimizing exposure here. There is an alternative to going across Lake Michigan. In weather, there's no alternative to going into Portland. If the winds are out of northwest, you're going to get the ILS 29er.
And it's truly a risk management issue and comfort levels. We all have different comfort levels. I mean, it's a darn big ocean, you know, that we fly over, and there's some, you know, some exposure, you know, and it's, once again, it's about risk management. So people need to think about this. People need to have a comfort level and just accept that, but accept also that if that's a big King's X, I'm not going over, be prepared to deal with the consequences of that. If they send you that way, or that's the only place the weather is good, you have to make a clear choice, and you best make that plan ahead of time rather than on the spur of the moment. Because on the spur of the moment, you'll probably make a bad decision, and bad decisions we often regret.
I think my point is the takeaway here is that think about where your risk exposure is and what you're willing to take. I have no problem with that 15-minute overwater leg. Now, I would certainly think about it. I would feel that I've got enough time to get closer to shore on the glide. We had PLBs. I know that there's, you know, Coast Guard helicopters or whatever that could potentially come out and get us. But if that's uncomfortable, that's fine. I would never fault anybody for that. But then also look at the other places in your flying where you're accepting a situation without thinking about it, where you're not prepared. The ILS 29 into Portland, I don't normally have a PLB and a life preserver on, right? I'm not going to stand up in that water, especially if they're 4-foot waves, long enough for them to get to me from shore. It ain't going to happen. So if that is a risk exposure you're not willing to do, then that's also something you should consider declining. I won't take that approach. I'll go to a different airport. I'll ask for a different approach, even if I have to circle, whatever that happens to be. It's more about thinking what you're comfortable with, finding something that works for you, and then looking at all of your flying and finding the places where, oh, maybe I should reassess that.
And really, what we're looking at here is tools. Okay, we have a big tool bag, and realize, you know, one size does not fit all. And when you go into that tool case, you know, recognize, you know, what you're picking out and why you're picking it out, and it's going to take you where you want to be.